Morning. You probably recall in Genesis chapter 4 when after Eve had given birth to Cain and Abel, how Cain hated his brother Abel because Abel's works were righteous and his were wicked. And so he slew his brother. And when God found this out, he cursed Cain to travel as a vagabond throughout the world and have no place of his own, to be an outcast among mankind. And when Cain heard this, he said, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." And you'll also recall that God placed on Cain a mark. Now, the concept of marking is pretty common in the Bible. Often, it's used symbolically or metaphorically or spiritually to denote God's people, how God identifies His people as opposed to the rest of mankind. But this mark was of a different nature, because this mark was to let other men know that Cain traveled about under the protection of God. It was to ensure Cain that vengeance was not going to be taken out upon him by another man for having slain his brother. But Cain chose not to walk about under the protection and assurance of God. It says that Cain went east and established a city, which he named after his first son, Enoch. Now, this first city represents several things. This first city of man. It first of all represents rebellion, which was just read, about which was read for us just now. It also represents a rejection of the promises of God. And it also represents man's eternal quest for security and safety apart from God. Cain had the full assurance that he was going to be protected as long as he walked about with this mark on him. But Cain chose to protect himself by building a city. Now, this first city that's mentioned in the Bible was made by men's hands. It was made by man to suit man. And it was made by man to protect himself from other men. It's the only institution of man recorded in the book of Genesis, in the first few chapters there anyway. It's man's first institution that he made himself. It was not made by God. Now, we have another city spoken of in Revelation chapter 21, and this is the city of God, and it is contrasted to the city of Cain. It is not made by hands. Its builder and maker is God. It is made to suit God, and it is made to glorify God. Now, it's interesting to note that in the Bible, as we have it told us in Genesis chapter 1, God's ideal was to create man and place him in a natural setting, in a garden, and have him tend it. But man rebels, and he builds himself a city because he can't trust God. A man who rebelled against God can't trust God. So the city itself is an irony. Yet God turns this institution around throughout the course of the Bible, and in eternity, He idealizes it. The Bible, you might say, begins and ends with a city. The Bible may be seen, in fact, as a narrative of the enmity between these two cities. The city of Cain versus the city of God. In fact, were it not for Charles Dickens, the Bible could really be called A Tale of Two Cities. I'd like to spend some time this morning talking about the ultimate city of Cain. If you and I were Hellenistic or Roman generals or statesmen 2,000 years ago, there was only one man that we would want to emulate. We would all want to be Alexander the Great. He was the ultimate man. He was the conqueror. He defined conquest. So that's who we would want to be if we could. Julius Caesar paid homage and burned incense to the grave of Alexander in Alexandria, Egypt. The Roman Emperor Trajan, when he visited a ruined Babylon in 116 AD, went to the very room where Alexander died so that he could pay homage to Alexander. Alexander was the guy. He was the hero for a long time. That's who you wanted to be. And we would dream of establishing an empire. And the empire that we would want to establish would not be Rome. it would be Babylon. Babylon was the empire. So the emperor or the conqueror was Alexander, but the empire was Babylon. And this is even true today to some extent. We've all taken Western Civ classes, probably in junior high or high school. And when we talk about Greece, we're interested. We think Greece is neat and that their little democracy was really cute as they tried it out for about 50 or 60 years there. And some of their architecture was pretty cool. And Rome, when we learn about Rome, it's inspiring. And we think of the majesty of Rome and how cultured they were and how neat. But Babylon is different. There's a different mystique that's attached to Babylon. It's almost like you should whisper the word Babylon when you talk about it. Well, that mystique was present in ancient times as well. Babylon always was separate from every other city and empire before and after. It was mystical and mysterious. Of course, it was Eastern. And in fact, in a very real way, Babylon defines what it is to be Eastern. And the city itself, there's never been anything quite like the city of Babylon. It set the standard and ideal for what an empire was supposed to be. It was the dream itself. Babylon was unique. The empires of Babylon were unique for several reasons. And one of them is that Babylon was only a prominent imperial city for three time periods, and all for relatively short periods of time, which may have added to the mystique, kind of like Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison. They all died at the age of 27, and that kind of adds a certain whatever to their legacy. But Babylon, when it was at its height, was at its height for a relatively short time. Another thing that makes Babylon unique is when it was the most powerful city in the world, it was always under non-native rulers, which is also weird, considering the nature of empires. This morning I'd like to discuss Babylon, a little bit of Babylon's founding and history, its culture and contributions to Western civilization, and its end and legacy. Now we have the founding of Babylon in Genesis chapter 10 and 11. I'd like to turn there briefly, because I think what little information we have in these chapters informs us just what Babylon represents, at least as its legacy is told us in the Bible. Now, we have here, starting in verse 6, the sons of Ham, who is, of course, one of the sons of Noah after the flood. And it gives a list of his sons. And then it says his last son, verse 8, Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, which is Sumerian Uruk, Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the principal city. So here in this list, we have quite a bit of information about this one guy. For the most part, we're just told these guys' names, and the names are familiar to us. For instance, Ham begot Cush, which became a nation. He begot Mizraim, which was Egypt eventually, and several others. But then we have this Nimrod who appears, and it says that he began to be a mighty one in the earth, or on the earth. And it says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now, it's in the next chapter that we get a little bit more information about the founding of Babel, and it doesn't really connect it back to Nimrod, but I think we can certainly place it in the same time period, because we're all within the first two or three generations after the flood, once men had begun filling the earth. So after a few generations, chapter 11, verse 1, Now the whole earth had one language and one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, just where the previous chapter told us, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. Asphalt occurs naturally from bitumen and is very common in the Mesopotamian Fertile Crescent. Verse 4, "And they said, Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city." So Babel is the beginning of civilization. Apparently something else that God doesn't desire too much. And when you consider the history of cities and civilization, men become increasingly violent and filled with more and more wickedness. And in fact, urban areas still have that stigma attached to them today. If you want to die young, you go to the city. That's just the way it is. Because we can't stop killing ourselves. I don't know why. But that's really the legacy of cities, and that's really what Babel represents. It's the first city, and it's the first civilization. Whoever this is, and it may be Nimrod, this may be one of his stories, after all, says he founded Babel. They're coming together to build this city and build this tower. I'd like to take a moment here and all right, as little as possible. But let's read verse 9 real quick of chapter 11. "Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth." Well, it says that the name of the place is Babel because God confused the language. Well, this is the Holy Spirit doing a play on words here. The Hebrew for confused is Belal, and it just means to confuse. But it does go ahead and give us the real name, which is Babel. That's in Hebrew. Hebrew was a Western Semitic language. And in the Eastern Semitic languages, primarily Akkadian, it was called Bab-il. You may recognize this part of the word here, because El means God. And Bab means gate. So Babel is the gate of God. And that may inform us a little bit more as to the purpose of this tower. Because I think that what Babel also represents here is that this is man-made religion, perhaps. It could be that the Tower of Babel is the first ziggurat that man ever constructs. And we know from later ziggurats that still exist today that they were built in stages. They were basically step pyramids. And at the top of the ziggurat, you had a chapel. And that was the God's house. So perhaps this represents man-made religion. In fact, in Revelation chapter 18, Babylon is called the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So once again, perhaps the source or originator of idolatrous worship. And here's another thing that's interesting. With this ancient name of Babel, we perhaps have preserved the last vestige of monotheistic religion in the world. The later Akkadian name for Babylonian, or for Babylon, was Bab-ilu. The U there, or the U at the end, just makes it plural. So Babel, the gate of God, becomes the gate of gods. So perhaps Babel is also not only the beginning of idolatrous worship, but perhaps polytheistic worship as well. At least it contains that very same spirit. So where do we get Babylon? Well, we have Babylon from the Greek, which is their version of Babilu, and that's just how we come up with Babylon. So that's how the name of the city changed, but it's always been on the same site. And in fact, the great ziggurat of Babylon that was still there in the day of Nebuchadnezzar is still there, the foundations of which, and most people agree that the foundation of that ziggurat is extremely, extremely ancient. It may in fact be the very foundation that this Tower of Babel was built on. The plain of Shinar is a unique region in the world. It's very flat. It's some of the flattest ground in the world. And because of the inundations of the Tigris and Euphrates, it's also one of the most fertile. At least in ancient times it was. And there's no wonder then that this is where man chose to first congregate. And in fact, archaeology tells us that the first civilizations did arise in the southern Mesopotamian region around this time, and we're probably, if my chronology is any good at all, we're probably in the early 3rd millennium BC when we're talking about Nimrod and the founding of Babel. It also tells us in chapter 11 that they came from the east. Well, that's another thing that archaeology confirms to us. The earliest settlements and cities that we know of today archaeologically are all in the mountains of Iran, which is directly east of Mesopotamia. It says they came from the east. Remember when man was first kicked out of the garden, they kicked him east of Eden. When Cain ran away from his family after killing Noah, he ran east. So they came from the east. Men came from the east to the plain of Shinar. All of this confirmed by archaeology. Now we're told also about Nimrod that this was the beginning of his kingdom, and that he began to be a mighty one on the face of the earth. And I have a theory as to why we're told this information here. It was a tradition among ancient Shinar, which may be another name for Sumer, that they kind of took turns being prominent cities. A king would become great and make his city the prominent city, and then he would die, and his sons were not near as tough as he was. So another king in another city would rise and make itself great, and that would continue. And during this third millennium BC, Babylon went and became something of a cow town. It continually decreased in prominence until the Sumerian cities in the south completely took over. Until the time of Sargon the Great in the 23rd century BC, we don't really have any record of Babylon at all. But it is mentioned as being near his capital, which was Agade, or Akkad. And Sargon was the founder of the Akkadian Empire in that region. And from that time on, the land of Shinar started being called the land of Sumer and Akkad. And in fact, for the next 1,000 years, anyone who ruled that region took the title the King of Sumer and Akkad. I'd like to spend briefly the next few moments giving us a brief idea as to the history of Babylon from the 3rd millennium BC up until the Persian Empire. You remember, we're told that Abraham came from the city of Ur of the Chaldees. Well, Ur was the most prominent city in the late 3rd millennium BC in Mesopotamia. After the fall of the 3rd dynasty of Ur, under which Babylon had become just a provincial center, the city became the nucleus of a small kingdom under an Amorite called Sumu Abim, whose successors consolidated the city's status as a leading city. And in fact, this so-called first dynasty of Babylon would constitute the old Babylonian Empire, the old Babylonian kingdom. And this is the dynasty that gave Babylon its mystique for the next 2,000 years. They raised it from the level of a cow town to the most prominent city in Mesopotamia. Art, literature, mathematics, astronomy, all of these things flourished under the first dynasty of Babylon. And from that time on, Sumer and Akkad would be known as Babylonia. And Babylon would, from that time until the time of Christ, be the most prominent city in southern Mesopotamia. Such was the strength of Babylon's culture throughout these 2,000 years that everyone who ruled it assimilated to it, as opposed to vice versa. After the first dynasty, it went through what was called a Kassite period. And judging by the native names of the Kassite rulers, they were Indo-Europeans, kind of related to the Hittites. But they completely adopted Babylonian culture. The mystique was already there, and its allure was so pervasive that it could not be denied. Even the Assyrians, who were actually historically probably more successful than Babylon, considered Babylon its cultural mother, kind of like the Romans would regard the Greeks as their cultural mother. They stole everything from Babylon, all of their learning, all of their religion. the religion of Babylon would become the default religion of the Mesopotamian region for 1,500 years. Babylon was just an amazing culture. Its ability to gobble up every other influence and spit it back out. There's never been another culture like that. If you came into contact with Babylon, you ended up a Babylonian, almost invariably, with one exception, and that was the Jews in the exile. Proof of the power of God, I think. But the Babylonians just swallowed everything else up. No one could deny or resist them. This first Babylonian empire was destroyed basically in around 1595 BC. It went through several centuries under the Kassites. And then a group called the Arameans, who founded Syria, came into prominence in southern Mesopotamia, traveling from the west. There was a particular group of Arameans called the Chaldeans, and they would establish what was called the Chaldean dynasty, and that's the dynasty that most of us are familiar with. The Chaldeans were basically tribesmen in the first half of the first millennium BC, but they gradually assumed more and more of a Babylonian identity, even though they were not native Babylonians themselves. And all through this time period where Assyria was on the rise and was the most powerful state in Mesopotamia and probably the world, there was a growing conflict between the two regions, Babylonia in the south and Assyria in the north. And it was interesting because that's where Assyria considered itself to have come from, which the Bible somewhat confirms. From the 9th to the late 7th century, however, Babylon was under Assyrian suzerainty, usually wielded through native kings who were Babylonians but paid homage to Assyrian kings. Things changed under Tiglath-Pileser III, who ruled from 744 to about 727 BC, and he's called Pul, P-U-L, in the Old Testament. And this was as a result of increasing pressure from the Chaldean tribesmen in the south. They were constantly harassing Assyria. And the first Babylonian mentioned by name in the Bible is Merodach-Baladan, who twice achieved independence from Assyria as king of Babylon. And you know Merodach-Baladan because it was his envoys in 2 Kings 20 and elsewhere that Hezekiah showed the temples of his house and the temples of the treasury of the temple in 2 Kings 20 and elsewhere. And he was told that all that treasure was going to end up in Babylon someday. Apparently, Merodach-Baladan had sent his envoys to Hezekiah in order to form an alliance, because basically at this time, Judah and Babylon were the only semi-independent nations in all the world that did not pay homage to Assyria. But that would not last. In fact, Merodach-Baladan's second reign would only last 1 year until he was suppressed by the Assyrians. Disorders accompanying the Chaldean tribes' increasing violence against Assyria persuaded Sennacherib, who is also mentioned in the Bible, who ruled Assyria from 704 to 681 BC, that to peacefully coexist with Babylon was impossible, and he basically destroyed the city that then was. And that's interesting because such was the prestige of Babylon that its citizens were exempt from certain taxes that everyone else in the empire had to pay. It had special funding for its schools and its temples because it was the cultural capital of the Mesopotamian region of the world. This policy was quickly reversed by Sennacherib's son Esarhaddon, who returned all of those things and in fact rebuilt the city. It was after Ashurbanipal's death that a man named Nabopolassar in 626 made a successful bid for independence and established the Chaldean dynasty in Babylon. And his son, who ruled from 605 to 561, is the Nebuchadrezzar from the Bible. And it's actually a scribal error that we call him Nebuchadnezzar. His actual name is Nebuchadrezzar, and it means favored of Nebo, who was the alleged son of the chief god Marduk and was the god of wisdom. Now, Nebuchadrezzar was a brilliant young general, and he led a successful campaign against Assyria with his allies, the Medes. This campaign culminated in the famous Battle of Carchemish, where the Assyrian yoke was broke for all time and established the Chaldean dynasty, or what's sometimes called the Neo-Babylonian Empire. and it would continue on for only 70 years. Yet it is this 70 years that for which Babylon is the most famous. And we'll talk briefly about that in a few moments. But Babylon, that empire, would last for only those few short years, and then it would be taken over by the Persians, and then it would be taken over by the Greeks, and very briefly by the Romans. And eventually, Babylon, the greatest city that the world had probably has ever known, simply vanished from history and under the sands of the Iraqi desert. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon was the largest city in the world, covering about 4 square miles. The Euphrates, which has shifted course at least 3 times since his day, flowed through it. The older part of the city was on the east bank of the Euphrates River. There, the central feature was called the Isagila, which was the great temple complex of Marduk, their chief god, with its associated ziggurat, which may indeed sit on the very foundation of the Tower of Babel. The ziggurat still exists and has a base of 300 feet square, and it's as tall as it is wide. So it's 300 feet tall, making it one of the most impressive structures of the ancient world still in existence. It was built in 7 stages or layers, and it was built in blue. So it would have been quite an amazing thing to see this temple in the city of Babylon. Along the Euphrates, particularly in the neighborhood of this Isagila, were quays for trading vessel, and the river was spanned by a bridge that was over 800 feet long on brick piles capped by stone, connecting it to the western half of the city. The streets were laid out on a grid with the main axis parallel to the river, and from the Isagila northward passed the processional way, which was which alongside it ran enameled lions. And then you would pass through the Ishtar Gate, which is probably the most famous gate in the ancient world, as it was a double fortress, essentially, that allowed access to the inner city. And it was adorned with enameled bulls and dragons, and it led to the famous Akitu House, where the idol of Marduk was taken for the New Year festival. It was during the New Year festival that Belshazzar, who was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, was celebrating when the Persians came in and took the city. It's from Greek tradition that we are told that Nebuchadnezzar also had established the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which were one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. It's been estimated that there were so many bricks used in the construction of Babylon that if you were to place them end to end on the equator, it could wrap around the earth 11 times. Billions and billions of bricks were used in the construction of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. In fact, it was almost considered that the city itself might be one of the ancient wonders of the world. It's estimated that Babylon was the first city to surpass 200,000 people in population, and judging by the size of the area that the ruins today encompass, that would have been easily done. The cultural achievements of Babylon are almost too lengthy to list. From the 19th century BC on, Babylon was the most educated city in Mesopotamia, and its achievements in literature, astronomy, mathematics, medicine, at least matched those of ancient Egypt. They, in fact, developed the Pythagorean theorem 1,000 years before Pythagoras did. And they developed the first true schools and system of learning. Their religion became, like I said, the default religion of Mesopotamia and was the holiest city of Mesopotamia for almost 2,000 years. They gave us astrology and, thankfully, the zodiac and horoscopy. No, I'm just kidding. They were regarded by the Greeks as the originators of magic. And from that time on, Babylon has been surrounded with a certain mystique that no other empire or city can even come close to matching. They were one of the first civilizations with a codified system of laws and a system of courts. And this code influenced every other code of law ever to come through Mesopotamia up until Roman times. Such is the city of Babylon as we have it in history, probably the most impressive city of man ever to sit upon the face of the earth. And for all of its achievements, it represents what man can do when he comes together and puts his mind to something, but also his tendency to rebel against God and pervert something that could be good. And the Bible, in fact, presents God versus Babylon, and it's striking. For all its achievements, might, and splendor, Babylon could not withstand the curse of God. And the sins of Babylon are many. Pride, as we're told in Jeremiah 50, 31, and 32. You remember in Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar walking around, "Is this not Babylon the Great, which I have built for a royal dwelling, for the pride of my honor and for the glory of my majesty?" It would have been hard for us not to understand if we could see Babylon, how Nebuchadnezzar probably felt when he looked at the Ishtar Gate, which he had built three times during his reign, and each time it was bigger and more magnificent. They were also major oppressors of the known world, and they sucked up all of the wealth of the ancient world into that city. And in fact, part of the reason their empire lasted so short is because Nebuchadnezzar spent so much of that wealth making his city what it was. They were oppressive to the people they had conquered. And also, their rampant idolatry, as told us in Jeremiah 50:38. It was a land filled with idols. You can also reference 51 verse 7. You remember in Revelations chapter 17, perhaps, that it was called the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the world. It could very well, like I said earlier, be the birthplace of idolatry and also perhaps polytheism or paganism. It was in the early second millennium BC that we had the first concept of a god king. And this was a Babylonian king who took an epithet that styled himself a divinity. So it was no wonder then that God hated this city, because all of these sins it practiced on God's own people. Let's turn real quickly to Isaiah chapter 13. Of all the prophecies I read through in the last week or so, I kind of chose this one to be representative of God's enmity towards Babylon. And I'll read starting in verse 19. "And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents there. Nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there, but wild beasts of the desert will be there, and their houses will be full of owls, ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, and jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come, and her days will not be prolonged." After the Persian period, Babylon continued to be the cultural and administrative center of the Persian Empire and exerted a lot of influence in that time period. But Babylon, the Babylonians, still thought of themselves as the masters of the world, and they spent the next 100 years continuously revolting against the Persians. Eventually, the Persians ransacked and virtually destroyed the city, took all of its idols, which were symbols of independence, and taxed it so heavily, and I'm not making a political statement here, but they taxed Babylon so heavily that it became a depressed country and could never rise from that again. In fact, they were taxed so heavily and there was so little money in Babylon during these last few centuries of the BCs that they couldn't maintain their buildings, and the city, which had been so magnificent, literally began to crumble apart around them. Alexander took the city from the Persians in 331 BC, and I'll close with a few thoughts about that. But after the time of Alexander, Babylon just continued to decline. Around 24 AD, the Nabatean city of Palmyra established a trading colony there, but it seems that the city itself was completely abandoned by then, and certainly no later than 75 AD. Two Roman emperors traveled to Babylon, but they found nothing but ruins. Now, in Isaiah 13:20, there's a verse there that says that the Arabians would not pitch their tents there. It's known that even up until the time of, even past the time of Muhammad, in the 600s AD, the Arabians considered the site of Babylon cursed and would not go anywhere near it, just as God had said. Trajan was a Roman emperor, and in 116 AD, he conquered Mesopotamia. In fact, he's the only Roman emperor to ever stand and put his feet in the Persian Gulf. He passed through Babylon, and like I said earlier, he paid homage in the room where Alexander had died. This is what's interesting about Babylon, is it does seem to have this curse. Because Trajan, while he and his Roman armies conquered Mesopotamia and dealt the Parthian Empire a major blow, it virtually bankrupted Rome. It was the first time that a Roman army lost money on a venture. And from that point on, the Roman army would operate in a deficit. And also, I'm not making a political commentary about our own times here. But that led to the chaos of the 3rd century, which led to the end of the Roman Empire. Every conqueror who touched Rome met this ill fate. Septimius Severus was the last Roman to pass by Rome. He camped there one night before going on to attack the Neo-Persian Empire. And he died shortly thereafter. And his family died violent death shortly thereafter. Just this curse. And I'll end my thoughts with Alexander, because I think it's the most interesting. Alexander conquered the Persian Empire and went on to conquer parts of India even. And he established the world's largest empire by the age of 24. And he had some grand plans for Babylon. He wanted to make Babylon the capital of his new empire. And he had already set aside monies to refurbish the entire city. He was going to rebuild its temples to Marduk and reestablish the priesthoods there and make it what it had been before. In fact, his plan was to make it greater than it had ever been before. And this is significant because keep in mind, Alexander established at least 27 cities named Alexandria, but he didn't choose any of them for the capital of his new empire. He wanted Babylon because Babylon was the city. It was the empire. Well, he got back from India after 10 years of conquest. He came back to Babylon, and he was getting ready to conquer the Arabian Peninsula. When on June 2nd of 323 BC, he caught a fever, because Babylon had basically become a swamp by this time and was full of malaria. He died on June 13th, 323 BC, at the age of 32. And because of his death, his empire was divided, and there followed centuries of warfare, and Babylon was virtually forgotten and continued its slow, steady decline. And I think that stands as the greatest testimony to the promises of God. God had said that this city will never rise again. And some of you may remember that in 1983, Saddam Hussein vowed that he was going to rebuild Babylon. He was going to reestablish it as the capital of Iraq. And shortly thereafter, he was deposed, 20 years, but that's short in the time frame of God. He was killed as well. Every conqueror who sought to make Babylon something after God had cursed it died very quickly and sometimes very horribly. I've always just thought that was fascinating. Babylon eventually was covered by desert, and it wasn't until the 17th century that we even found it again. It was such a curse to the Arabians that they didn't even want to appoint European explorers in the direction of where they thought Babylon had once stood. When God makes a promise, that promise comes true, and He promised that Babylon was going to die and was never going to rise again. Now, I've been in some conversations with people, and they say, yeah, but it continued as an inhabited city for another 600 years almost. I've always thought that was interesting, because God could have just swept it out of the way, destroyed it quickly. But then I think it probably would have been somewhat forgotten. God strangled it and allowed it to die a slow, agonizing death. And I've always thought that was perhaps part of His plan as well, so that the world could watch it wither and die. This city that everyone regarded as the greatest of all cities ever, and it probably was by human standards. But he let them watch it die and rot slowly, but efficiently. And that's living testimony to the power of God and His ability to keep promises. And if God can keep that promise, which no one has been able to reverse by rebuilding Babylon, then I think God can keep any promise that He makes. And that gives me a lot of hope. The destruction of God's enemies is always the salvation of His people. I can't think of a time in the Bible where God didn't save His people by also destroying their enemies. And on the last day, God is going to destroy all of His enemies through His Son, Jesus Christ. And He is going to take His people, His chosen ones, to the city, whose builder, that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Think about all the achievements of mankind in the last 100 years. Did you know that technology is now progressing at a rate of 1,000 times what it has in any other previous century? When I'm old and on my deathbed, who knows what will be capable of? But for all of man's advancements, the one thing he's never been able to overcome is his rebellion to God. It's something that happened very early in our history, and it's something that to reverse the effects of, God had to send his only son to reverse. And I'd like us all to think about that. I'm an amateur historian, and I've always encouraged people to try and read as much of the past as they can and try to understand it, because I think it informs us a little bit. I think sometimes the ancients knew or understood a little bit more than we did. But Babylon represents a departure from that. And I think that's a departure that has taken the entire world globally away continuously from God. Because that's really what Babylon represents, is perpetual rebellion against God. If you would like to give yourself to Jesus Christ to make Him your King and Lord, we invite you to do so as we stand and sing the number that fills the light.